Welcome to Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA.
Even today, nearly 70 years later, the dreadful words evoke a heart-stopping chill. All Jews in the city of Kiev and its surroundings will present themselves on Monday, September 29th, 1941, at 8 a.m., at the corner of Melnik and Doktoryskaya Street, beside the cemetery. Documents, money, and valuables, as well as warm things, underwear, and so on, are to be brought. Anyone not carrying out this order and found elsewhere will be shot. This was the prelude to Babi Yar, site of the callous massacre of tens of thousands of men, women, and children that epitomized those chapters of the Holocaust conducted by the Nazis in the occupied territory of the Soviet Union. The brutality of this slaughter and its implicit evidence of collaboration with evil are well portrayed in a collection entitled The Unknown Black Book, the direct testimony of those who witnessed these stunning atrocities and others and narrowly survived themselves. My guest is Joshua Rubinstein, Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International and co-editor with Ilya Altman of The Unknown Black Book, The Holocaust in the German-Occupied Soviet Territories. Josh, welcome to Dialogue.
Good to be with you, George.
Let me hold up this book so that our viewers can get it firmly in their minds as something that I think is a must reading for moral as well as intellectual
sure.
reasons.
Thank you.
Josh, one of the reasons I think it's must reading is because these accounts, they're nearly 100, have a very special quality. I want to approach this first. And it may derive from two facts. I want to get your take on this. One is their immediacy. They
yes.
were sort of done right almost as in the immediate aftermath of these things. And the second is that this testimony was very often taken by liberating soldiers, particularly very often Jewish soldiers
yes.
who had a particular understanding of it. Are those facts, and do they in fact give it a special kind of quality?
Well, they give it a very special quality. We're used today seeing interviews with survivors decades later in an acquired language, in English or perhaps in Hebrew if they're conducted in Israel. Steven Spielberg has an ambitious project. The U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum is always looking for survivors and interviewing them. And it's wonderful they're survived. It's wonderful they can enjoy their children and grandchildren. But these testimonies in the Unknown Black Book were taken down immediately after liberation in Ukraine, in Belarus. So they have a very raw quality.
Right.
But secondly, there's no intervening knowledge of the Holocaust. These people were living in their towns and cities. The Germans came like locusts to a wheat field, rounded up the Jews, killed them, and here and there people survived. They don't know about Auschwitz. They don't know about Treblinka. They don't know what's happening to Hungarian Jewry in 1944,
exactly.
1945. They just know these murderers come, mm-hmm. without explanation, round them up, and a handful survive miraculously. And so they convey all of that horror, that bewilderment, immediately to these soldiers, who are also survivors. Many
right.
of them are Jewish. They lost relatives. They fought the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a connection between the person who survives and the liberating Red Army soldier that we lose today so many decades later.
That bewilderment, Josh, and it's a well-taken word, comes through in full force as the reader. There's just a riveting, gritty quality about all of these accounts. Is this, in a sense, Josh, this is the other Holocaust in my mind, the one that took place outside of the camps and outside of Germany.
Right.
And like you say, people were bewildered because they had no knowledge of the wider horrors surrounding them. Is there a sense of prelude in what we're seeing here as to what would happen in Germany, a kind of working out of the
sure.
awfulness?
I think one of the things I tried to do for this book when I wrote my introduction was to place this dimension of the Holocaust, what the Germans were doing in occupied Soviet territory, within the broader context of Holocaust history. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, it all begins with Hitler's accession to power in 1939. He occupies Western Poland. The Soviets invade from Eastern Poland. The Germans set up ghettos in places like Warsaw and Lodz. But there's no systematic killing. We believe that perhaps 50,000 Jews died, between 1939 and the German invasion of the Soviet Union in June of 1941. Now, that's a horrifying figure, but it's small change for what the Germans were capable of. As soon as they invade Soviet territory, they dispatch shooting units behind the invading Wehrmacht, behind the German army. And they're the ones who hunt down the Jews. And this is the beginning of mass murder. And it doesn't need Auschwitz. This is independent of the killing centers in Poland.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because these Einsatzgruppen and these groups that they will dispatch to carry out this are something I want to touch on in depth in just a moment. But it's also true, and I think you've also alluded to this, that as I understood it, there were only maybe less than 500,000 Jews in Germany per se at that point.
Yes.
But 4 million in the occupied. In other words, the bulk of the Jewish population was in these occupied
territories. Right. So if we have this principal image of the Holocaust of the German Jews being targeted, or Jews like Anne Frank and her family in Amsterdam who are hunted down, they try to conceal themselves, they're found, they're put on trains, they're sent to Poland, this is the fate of 2 to 3 million Jews, and it's a horrifying aspect of the Holocaust, the killing centers in Poland. But as many as 2.5 million Jews are killed on occupied German territory in the Soviet Union. And they are not shipped to Poland. They're killed in situ, in their towns, in their villages, outside of Kiev.
And there are two particular additional horrors to that. That 2.5 that million Jews residing in the territories who are killed represent more than half of the Jewish population that was existent there
prior
to the war.
That's right.
Clearly, that's a horror in itself, but perhaps, who says what's greater here?
Right.
Additionally, it has to be admitted, and it's one of the powerful points of this book, that it's the role of civilian collaborators.
Right.
That is one of the main reasons we have such a massive death toll.
I mean, keep in mind, Anne Frank and her family are shipped from the Netherlands to Poland. The mass murder is not taking place in the Netherlands or in France or in Czechoslovakia, wherever the Jews are being rounded up. They take the victims to the killers in Poland. But in Soviet territory, the killers come upon the victims. And the numbers are so great, the Germans need collaborators from the Ukrainian population, among the Latvian population, the Lithuanian population, to carry out the killings. After all, we began our conversation today with your comments about Babi Yar, but the shooters at Babi Yar were Ukrainians.
Right.
The Germans organized the killing. Obviously, without the Germans, it would not have taken place. But the Germans relied not only on active collaboration, meaning the actual killing, but one of the aspects of these testimonies that neighbors were arguing among themselves who gets to steal the bedding, who gets to steal the silverware, who can go into the apartment first to take it over and take the belongings. And that's what's so disturbing as well.
I hang my head only because, I mean, as a human testimony, it's just 70 years later, it's awful.
Right.
Is this consistently true through all the territories, Josh? I mean, Ukraine, Crimea, Belarusia, this same
phenomenon. Well, actually, it isn't always consistent. First, let's be fair. Many of these people survived because of the active and courageous acts of their neighbors who hid them, who brought them food, who took their children in and played a game that the children were theirs, that they were not Jewish. And every one of those people risked their lives and the lives of their families to help their Jewish friends and neighbors or unknown Jews they took in. And that did occur.
And are known as righteous among nations.
Absolutely. Whether or not they're recognized years later at Yad Vashem, we should recognize them. But they were far and few between. Secondly, when the Germans entered Russian territory, not just Ukraine, but what is Russia within the Soviet Union, there was less collaboration. By then, people understood the scale of the killing. They understood this was a foreign invasion.
Right.
There was a closer identification between the Russians and the Soviet government, whereas the Ukrainians were far more antagonistic to the Soviet government, and many welcomed the Germans. So within the Russian population, there was far less collaboration, and that's to their credit. But in places like Lithuania, that we believe there were as many as 500 pogroms, attacks on Jews, before the Germans started their own massacres.
This is a good point, and I want to approach the Lithuanian case myself very specifically because of that. In addition, or in corresponding to this, the civilian activities, there was a formal structure we touched on just a moment ago. I want to bring into greater detail now the Einsatzgruppen, and these were the, I guess, SA units, perhaps, four of them, sort of regionally distributed, who structured as much of this as they possibly could. Tell us something about their nature, who they were.
over the winter of 1940-41, Hitler and the High Command began to explain what was going to happen on the Eastern Front, that the war on the Eastern Front, meaning Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of Soviet territory, would be different from the war in the West against France and England. And by the spring of 1941, Hitler and Heydrich and Himmler organized four shooting units, mobile shooting units, who would follow the Wehrmacht north to south, A, B, C, and D, from the Baltic states through Belarus, Ukraine, to the Crimea, and with one sole purpose, to round up Jews, commissars, and saboteurs, principally Jews, and kill them outright. Now, they were joined by other army units and police units, but principally this was the gruesome work of these Einsatzgruppen, these mobile shooting units. And this was led by, they were led by SS generals.
Right, right.
And this is one of the horrifying aspects of the Holocaust.
Another horrifying aspect of it is, again, from the book, I gathered that a lot of these men were actually quite well-educated professionals. I mean,
yes.
They were not just the kind of riff-raff you would
not
expect.
Not at all. And
this.
They were, I mean, obviously there were sadists among them, but they were just convinced by Nazi ideology that it was right to do this, that they were, these were legal orders.
Mm-hmm.
If they'd been ordered not to kill them, they would have been happy not to kill them. But the ideology and the orders were consistent.
Mm-hmm.
They were consistent true believers in Hitler and Nazi Germany's ideology. And so they did it with relish. Now, it's also important to keep in mind, many of the men broke down, psychologically broke down.
Yeah, but you know, that's the only instance of sympathy you get from them in this book, when their commanders say, my men just can't take this. As though, I mean, this is the main consideration. My men are being disturbed by this. We must find some way of killing these people that doesn't bother my men so much.
Well, there are a couple of things to say about this. The commanders are very sensitive to the humane qualities of what they're doing. They don't want their men to be psychologically affected by this. So one of the commanders at his trial several years later says, well, I would not allow my men to shoot for more than 2 hours at a time. Now, you mentioned Babi Yar. They killed over 33,000 Jews in 2 days of continuous shooting. Think of when you go to a baseball game and you see 25 or 40,000 people in a stadium, what it would take to kill that many people in this crude method of shooting them in a day or two. The organization involved, the number of shooters you need, machine guns you need, what you do with the clothes, how you separate men from the women, all of that the Germans worked out. But it was trying for the killers to be continuously killing men, women, and children. They had families of their own. So two things happen. First, they make adjustments so that the men get a lot of liquor. They get time off in order to kind of make it easier for them. Secondly, we know that a number of men were sent back to Berlin. They were never punished. No one was ever punished for either refusing or for not being physically able or psychologically able to be engaged in mass murder. But more horrifying, one result was that the Germans invented the mobile gas vans.
Yes.
And this was an alternative to shooting Jews, that they would take a truck with a compartment.
Reroute the exhaust back into the
Seal compartment. The compartment, reroute the exhaust pipe to the floor. Then they'd put 15, 20, 30 people in the truck, drive 15 minutes, and they'd be asphyxiated. And the Germans believed, so they said, that this was easier for the killers and it was easier for the victims. So of the 2.5 million who were killed, several hundred thousand were killed in these mobile gas vans, 25, 30, 40 at a time.
Exactly. Josh, speak to us a bit about the provenance of the Unknown Black Book.
Yes.
Now, there's, and let me start by giving you what I think I've gleaned from this book and from our other conversations. There's a very important organization called the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee,
yes,
organized in the Soviet Union, whose principal purpose, as I understood it, was to begin to let the world know something of these horrors,
right,
as a way of animating Western opinion.
Right.
Now, but how does it go from that activity, collecting these stories by them, to the eventual publication?
Sure. The Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee was one of five anti-fascist committees set up by Stalin after the German invasion, principally to help restore relations with the West, because Soviet Union, Stalin's regime, had been an ally of Nazi Germany between 39 and 41, and there were very bad feelings. So after the German invasion, Stalin wants to repair those relations. He set up anti-fascist committees of Slavs, of women, of young people, of scientists, and the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee. All of them had a single purpose, to do propaganda, in the best sense of propaganda, in the West, to nurture hatred toward Nazi Germany and support for this unlikely alliance, the Western democracies and the Kremlin, Stalin's regime. So the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee, and one of its leading figures was the Soviet writer Ilya
Ehrenberg,
and Vasily Grossman, who was a Soviet journalist.
Right.
After all, they're Jewish. They're Soviet patriots. They see what the Germans are doing. They're horrified. So it's Ehrenberg, and then Grossman joins him to organize riders to follow the Red Army into liberated territory, immediately behind the Red Army, to find survivors, to find documents, in order to publish a black book.
Yeah.
So the unknown black book is among the material that was collected by Ehrenberg and Grossman during the war. Mm-hmm. That material was sent to Nuremberg. It was used against German leaders in Nuremberg. And they wanted to see it published first in Russian in the Soviet Union and then in many languages around the world. Stalin forbade its publication.
Mm-hmm.
So the Black Book, the original volume, was not published until 1980 by Yad Vashem in Jerusalem.
Right.
This material, the unknown Black Book, was collected at the same time. But because it dealt with collaboration by ordinary civilians, and there's also material about what the Romanians were doing in Ukraine, Stalin said, no, that is altogether to be kept out of the Black Book.
Right.
So those are two themes in the unknown Black Book that's different from the Black Book.
So Stalin's suppression of this, for example, I know that the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee, the original organizers of the material, were broken up, were they not, in 1948?
Yes. It's a complicated history,
right.
But after the war, the committee remained in existence because Stalin thought it would be convenient and useful because of what was going on in the Middle East, the establishment of Israel, the end of the British Mandate.
Right.
But then Jews in Moscow and elsewhere were obviously supporting the establishment of Israel. They greeted Golda Meir very fervently and enthusiastically when she came to Moscow in September of 1948, and the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee was held responsible for this Zionist activity.
Now, connect that event to the execution of the 13 dissidents in 1953. Because what I'm trying to get a sense of here is how the Soviets so effectively suppressed this and what connection it had with their attitudes toward those groups.
Yes. Well, first, let's be clear. The Soviet Union never actively denied the Holocaust.
No, they did not.
It was not interested in writing about it a great deal. It wanted to emphasize the broad suffering of the Soviet people. And within that context, Jews were victims, too.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't give it the prominence it deserved. After all, these were their citizens. It wasn't taking place 100 or 300 miles away.
That was problematic for them, though. I mean, the fact that some of their citizens were collaborating in this.
And that was part of it, too, obviously. Because it undercut this image of a united Soviet people fighting the Germans. So the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee is suppressed, it's closed, its leading figures are arrested, as well as hundreds of other Yiddish cultural figures who wrote in the Yiddish press in the Soviet Union, an official press. And of those hundreds, 15 are singled out for a secret trial in the spring and summer of 1952.
Right.
They're accused of bourgeois Jewish nationalism as exemplified by the Black Book, because that shows Jewish suffering as if it's worse than anybody else's suffering, and it's connected to support for Zionism and the establishment of Israel, and of course the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also accused of treason. They have this, you know, concocted accusation that the Jews were collaborating with the Americans and the Zionists to detach the Crimea and hand it over to the Americans as an imperialist beachhead. It was a complete concoction. But anyway, so there's this secret trial on the grounds of the Lubyanka, on the grounds of the headquarters of the secret police. Five of the defendants are well-known Yiddish writers,
right.
But it's all secret. In the end, they're convicted. 13 are executed. A 14th dies in prison. He had collapsed during the trial. And only one of the defendants, Lena Stern, who was a very famous scientist, survived. She was sentenced to exile. And after Stalin's death, she returned to Moscow. But she was so frightened by the experience, she never wrote about it or told anyone. Mm. So that is in August 12th, 1952, which is called the Night of the Murdered Poets. That's when those 13 were executed. Then you have the doctor's plot in January, which is the continuation where Stalin accuses a group of doctors of trying to poison Soviet leaders, and some are rounded up, and they're tortured. But then Stalin dies in March, and in April, the new Soviet government, after Stalin's death, disavows the doctors' plot, and the Jewish doctors are released, except for two who succumb to torture.
When these documents, the book, finally emerges in the West, that would be in 1980, right?
Yes.
And that was published in Yiddish, was it not?
It was published in several languages, in English, in Russian, and in Yiddish.
To what effect?
Well, it was a bombshell. I mean, the fact is that because of the Cold War, because we didn't have access to documents, because survivors weren't emigrating, and in the 70s, many survivors began to emigrate as part of the broader Soviet Jewish emigration, that aspect that we've talked about today was just neglected.
Right.
People focused on Anne Frank and Auschwitz and Treblinka, which is obviously horrifying aspects of the Holocaust, but there was this other dimension. And so when, as I've been learning myself, that of the 6 million Jews who were killed, over 2.5 million were in occupied Soviet territory. They weren't sent to Poland. They didn't know about Auschwitz. That is just a dimension we have to grapple with.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in grappling with it, let me turn to a couple of the accounts themselves as a reader. That, I mean, you can pick any one of the 93 or all of them, actually, and get the same effect. For example, in Ukraine, I hope I pronounce her name and her memory correctly, Ida Belozovskaya.
Yes.
Like so many people in this book, she suffered personal betrayal. I mean, this is a very personal aspect of this. She evidenced, and this is my note on her, a sort of a faith in the Red Army coming to her rescue that was absolutely poignant. And I wondered how typical that was of so many people.
Well, it was very poignant. After their country was being occupied, they were Jews. They were obviously victimized. Mm-hmm. And their only possible salvation was the arrival of the Red Army. There was no other way to survive in the end. People could help them day by day with food or not betraying them or taking in their children, but in the end, they needed the regime to come in and physically save them. Mm-hmm. And so there was great hope. And I think we should understand that and appreciate it. Whatever our other feelings we have about Stalin and the horrors of his regime, they were our allies in World War II. They bore the brunt of the fighting against the Germans. It was the Red Army that liberated Auschwitz, for example, on January 27th, 1945. Mm-hmm. And by then, all of Soviet territory had been liberated.
Another of my, I don't know, personal favorites, that sounds almost trivial. I don't mean it that way. But someone whose story left out. Emilia Borisovna Kotlova. Uh-huh. This woman, her spirit, I mean, still lives in a sense. I mean, she met all these horrors with not just courage, but with wit and a certain kind of resiliency, if you will. But she suffered horrors such as seeing, or at least knowing of, her sister and family being buried alive. This kind of thing, which leads to something that was another theme I saw throughout the stories, special savagery and degradation. For example, there's one horrific incident where people are taken to a slaughterhouse, actually made to act as though they were animals being led to slaughter.
Yes, that happened in Romania.
Where things were. So, I mean, speak on that. I mean, if you can.
Well, you know, at their trial in 1947, 1948, the commanders of the Einsatzgruppen insist that, yes, they were carrying out these killings, but they tried to make them as humane as possible. This shows the twisted logic of the Nazis. But we know that this was incredibly brutal. They were wiping out families in front of each other, including children. It's true, the Germans were horrified by the brutality of the Romanians. And this one incident that happened in Bucharest, where the Romanians rounded up several dozen Romanian Jews and killed them in a butcher house, in a slaughterhouse, and then afterwards hung the corpses on hooks, is just astonishing. And the Germans were always astonished and upset with the kind of brutality the Romanians displayed. For example, in Odessa, where there were corpses hanging at various corners throughout the city to intimidate the population. And the Germans preferred to bury their evidence, and they were upset that the Romanians wouldn't bury their victims. The Germans made a point of burying their victims, and when the tide started to turn, digging up these enormous mass graves and burning the bodies because they didn't want the Red Army to find the evidence. And this happened systematically in Ukraine, in Belarus, and it's just one more gruesome aspect of what the Germans were doing.
Let's talk about the conclusion of these matters, and particularly in the sense of justice that was done and justice that was not done.
Right.
And you had contributed a very, very excellent essay in this book about the trials and about what one might call the sliding scale of leniency.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about that.
Yes.
And relate it to the Einsatzgruppen.
Sure. Well, everyone remembers Nuremberg. Mm-hmm. But I think for most people, they believe there was one trial at Nuremberg, the International Military Tribunal, where leaders like Hermann Göring and Albert Speer, Rudolf Hess were brought to trial with other military and government officials. But in fact, there were 13 trials at Nuremberg. There were the big one and then 12 subsequent trials of bankers, of industrialists, of doctors. And one of those subsequent trials was of the leaders, the commanders, of the Einsatzgruppen. And that took place between 1947 and the spring of 1948. In fact, the judgment was given on April 10th, 60 years ago this spring. Mm-hmm. Now, the Americans brought these 23 defendants to trial.
Right.
Six of the defendants were SS generals. Mm-hmm. They had their own dispatches from the Eastern Front to Berlin, where they report, yes, we got to Kiev, and on these dates, we killed 33,320 Jews. We got to the city of Grodno, we killed 500 the first day, and then many thousands more in subsequent weeks. And when Benjamin Ferenc, who was an investigator for the Americans, saw these documents, he sat down with them in Berlin in 1946, and as he told me when I interviewed him, he took an adding machine, a primitive adding machine, right? And he started keeping track of how many victims. And when he got to 1 million, he stopped. And he took the material to Telford Taylor, who's one of the great heroes of Nuremberg, was an assistant to Justice Robert Jackson, the principal American prosecutor. And he said, look, we've got to go after these guys. We need a separate trial of these Einsatzgruppen commands. And Taylor hesitated because they didn't have a lot of money. They didn't have the budget they needed, the staff they needed. But Ferenc insisted. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was one separate trial for the leaders of the Einsatzgruppen. Now, by 47-48, the Americans and the British were not being so tough, right, with these defendants. In fact, of the 23 defendants, 14 were sentenced to death, more than in any other trial at Nuremberg.
Yeah.
But the Americans hesitate. Uh-huh. They don't want to carry out the executions. And in the end, only four are executed. And the rest, no matter what their sentence was, of death, 20 years, life in prison, by 1958, they are all out.
Josh, this is a cautionary tale for all of us. It's a story for 2008 and beyond. We must never forget.
Very good.
Thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Joshua Rubinstein. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Sharana Harris. Our assistant producer is Keila Jackson. And our production assistant is Rachel Golden. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.